From KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, here's the basic outline for Bob Garfield's new book. It comes from a summary. A neighborhood, a mob, a girl, a boy, another girl, another mob, a hit man, a hit woman, a recession, a chiropractor, and a twist. Those of you who know Bob from NPR's On the Media know he's done all kinds of writing, but this is his first novel, so it's giving us an opportunity to talk to him about the book and other things, too. The book is called Bedfellows. Bob calls it a comic mob thriller. One reviewer called it Goodfellas on Giggle Gas. It's a story set in a neighborhood, and sure, there are mobsters here, but it's also about the people in a community. Some good ones, some not so good ones. All of them are interesting, and all of them are trying to deal with the fact that things are changing. A conversation with Bob Garfield today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So many of you know Bob Garfield through his work on NPR over the years. He used to produce epic, funny, touching stories for All Things Considered. These days, of course, he's the co-host of the program On the Media. And as you probably also know, Bob knows the advertising business. He's written about it for years. So it makes sense that one of the characters in his new book, his new novel, is a failed ad executive who is reinventing his life. But there are also mobsters in this book, and I don't think he knows much about the mob, although we'll see. The book is set in a neighborhood, Ebbets Beach, Brooklyn, and the small businesses there pay protection money to a local crime family. And it's not your typical terrifying bunch of thugs. They, too, are part of the neighborhood. They help keep the scumbags off the street and sponsor the Little League team and the weekly bingo game. But things are changing for everyone in Ebbets Beach. Today in the program, Bob Garfield is with us to talk about this latest project of his, a comic mob thriller. And we invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Bob is, as I said, the co-host of WNYC and NPR's program On the Media. There's lots of other credits to his name. He's been an advertising critic, a contributing editor to newspapers and magazines. His writing has appeared in The New York Times and Sports Illustrated and Wired. He's the author of several books, including The Chaos Scenario. His latest book is called Bedfellows, and he's joining us from his home studio in an undisclosed location. Bob Garfield, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Thank me. Thank you. This is very kind of you.
I want to start with, okay, so a novel. Have you been thinking about a novel a lot? Do you figure everyone has a novel in them? Did you figure you had a novel in you?
When I was young, I imagined that I had a novel in me. I imagined that I had so much to offer the world. And I've come to unimagine that over the years. And you know, the fact is, everyone thinks they have a novel in them. The trick really is to get the novel out of them,
yeah.
Which involves just, oh my gosh, so much typing.
Right.
And it's tedious, and you sit in a chair, your back gets stiff, and it's probably going to be terrible. I'm happy to report, and you know, not to be too full of myself, but my novel in the end is not terrible. It's satisfactory.
So this particular, I want to work into the story and talk about the particulars, but this story that you had, when did it come to you? Was it something that you'd been thinking in the back of your mind?
No. I was taking a shower. I've got to say, I've made more money in my shower than any other room of my house.
Yeah.
That's where I do my thinking, get my ideas, actually a lot of my writing, the thinking up stuff part of my writing. And I was in a shower, and I got this kind of stupid idea about a mob that, like everybody else in a bad economy, was down on its luck,
yeah,
and just had to retrench in various ways. And by the end of the shower, which was an expensive one and environmentally unfriendly, I had conceived pretty much the whole thing. So in the space of 20 minutes, I had plotted out what I imagined as a film. And I have some friends in high places, and I called one of them who runs a movie studio in Hollywood, a famous name movie studio. And I said, okay, so here's my idea. So there's this mob, and it's down on its luck, and their territory is, the Russian mob is beginning to move in on them, and they end up having to hire this like off-price hitman and whose day job is as a chiropractor. Right. And I'm like, well, so what do you think? What do you think? And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. I said, so it's a movie, right? He said, well, no, not in this century it isn't. Maybe in the mid-70s it might have been a movie. And he said, but if you write it as a novel and it's in any way successful and it is and it's cinematic, you know, maybe somebody will pick up the option. So I said, all right, I'll do that. And in about 20 minutes – or actually more like 6 months, in my spare time, I wrote the novel.
So this is just essentially your way of trying to get a movie made.
Well, you know, just between you and me and a big part of the western part of the United States, yeah, that was the scheme. But I must say, I hate writing. I've made my living writing for something like 35 years. It's like bleeding through the eyes every time I sit at the keyboard. But this was fun because you don't have to know anything. You get to just kind of make stuff up.
You know what is so great about it is Ebbets Beach, which is, as you say in the book, it runs from 59th Street to the Bay Ridge Parkway. And I wanted to know where you came up with this place, because a lot of the book is this real fondness for a community, you know, a neighborhood, a place.
Yes, I came to be very fond of this fictional part of Brooklyn, and I became familiar with it by making it up out of whole cloth.
Yeah, really?
I grew up in – this is not my experience, yeah. this Brooklyn neighborhood mob life. I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia. My father was a manager of a paper plate factory, you know, and a pretty unsinister paper plate factory manager. Yeah. I think the closest thing I had to this kind of sociopathic behavior, some kids I think stole a copy of the SAT in my high school. So, you know, this is not drawn from my actual life experience. But like many other people, I have Google, and I Googled the whole thing. Hmm. So everything I know or think I know about Brooklyn, which I have been to only to travel through it on the BQE from Manhattan to the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. Right. Everything I know about Brooklyn, about about organized crime, about philately, about the mattress business, and everything else I write about in the book, I just totally Googled.
Hmm. The idea of it being like you had to come up with the kind of sensibility for, and it's funny, so there's something really comical about the characters themselves. But I guess the question, if it's a mob thriller, you know, where do you put the violence? How violent should it be? How dark should it be at moments? I mean, did you put this together bit by bit? Did you figure this is the kind of sensibility you wanted from the start? To talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's a mob novel, right? So the people you're writing about, by definition, are criminals who, at least in their past, have unspeakable violence. And the people, their adversaries in this book, are just beyond sociopathic. Yeah. I mean, they're evil with a capital E. And you know, even when they're being a relatively nice gang, they're running a protection racket and loan sharking and various other nefarious activities. And yet the challenge as a writer was to make them somehow likable, somehow more than two-dimensional. I think I got to about 2 1/3 dimensional. You know, they're not quite real human beings because they can't be. They're too absurd. And for this silly exercise in genre fiction to have some sort of literary merit. I mean, it had to be about something apart from the plot. And I think it was about something.
Yeah.
And maybe I won't do a spoiler alert now. And by the way, it also had to leave room for a sequel and perhaps become a series, because in the last two words of this 100,000-word novel, literally the last two words, resides the premise for all subsequent follow-up novels with the same cast of characters. And, you know, I either pulled it off or I didn't.
Yeah.
It, I, It's supposed to be a comic thriller, and I think, you know, I've described it as a semi-comic, semi-thriller, because it's, you know, it's not all that exciting and not all that funny.
So I can't tell if this is an experiment in some ways for you, kind of a literary experiment. Let me see if I can do this. Or if it was, as you were writing, it was like, no, this is, I mean, you're being pretty self-deprecating, but, you know, it's really good. It's really fun to read.
Oh, well, thank you. You're very kind to say. Well, it was fun to write. Once again, that was a new experience for me. Fun to write. And, you know, trying to contrive a plot is one set of problems. Trying to make interesting characters is another set of problems. Trying to make people laugh out loud is yet a third a challenge for an author. And then somehow to make it scan, and then somehow, at least thematically, to be something larger than itself. And, you know, whether I pulled all of those things off or not is not for me to say, but it was just like a puzzle.
Yeah.
And I got into it, body and soul for a brief period of time. You know, you alluded to in the intro that I do a lot of things for a living. I mean, I do a lot of things for a living, and I'm constantly juggling. But this enabled me certain periods of time where I was just totally immersed, and that was it was an experience.
Yeah. Let me ask about Jack Schiavone. Did I get that? Did I pronounce that right?
I pronounce it Schiavone.
Schiavone.
But,
okay.
You know,
sorry.
I don't know.
Yeah, I pronounce it Fabrizio, and I'm sure it's Fabrizio. But so Jack Schiavone, was he the first figure that comes to mind as you're sketching this out in the shower?
No, the first character I came up with was the discount hitman, a chiropractor who blundered into the assassination trade after, gosh, I've got to be careful. Yeah, I think I can go this far.
Yeah, be careful.
Accidentally killing a real patient with what turned out to be a fantastic assassination technique.
Right.
And, you know, he's a little desperate because that harmed his practice. The mob is a little desperate because all their rackets are in the toilet because of the recession. The loan trucking business is doing terribly because Citibank is, you know, beating them on price. And, and you know, they're kind of beside themselves.
In some ways, the mob is in this case, in your story, it's a local business. Like I said, it does the bingo game and funds the Legal Aid Society, which brings us to another great character, which we'll talk about. But and what do they want in return? You know, they want that little bit of protection money. They want a little bit of loyalty. But they're kind of like the pizza shop in some ways. They're just kind of part of the community.
They are part of the community. They're part of the fabric of the community. And you know, let me switch metaphors for a second because I'm senior American, and if I can grab a metaphor, I got to grab it while it occurs to me.
Right.
If the community were a house, they would be a load-bearing wall.
Yeah.
They're not just a criminal enterprise. They have become somewhere between a racket and a community service organization.
Right.
One of the characters tries to describe them as sort of like Hamas or Hezbollah. No,
yeah.
He tries to describe them as Hezbollah,
yeah.
Which built its authority in southern Lebanon, and not by threatening Israel, but by filling in where the failed government had left giant holes in social services and so forth. And it became a shadow government and thereby acquired political strength. Well, that's kind of what this mob, which rebranded itself the Cosa Nostra, had did. You know, our thing is to care.
Our thing is to care.
Their slogan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they became a sort of a Hezbollah, or as the Don Donato, the lead mob character, describes it, the Halava. He's kind of tendency towards malaprops. I apologize for that ringing phone.
That's okay. You were mentioning Big Manny, who compares the mob, this local mob, to the Hezbollah. And he says, the more we fill the needs of our community, the more power we will have. Big Manny is a great character. He kind of stumbles into all of this. And he's Not a terribly violent type. He's a big type. I guess he looks the part in some ways, but he's all about kind of finance.
He is a financial genius, kind of a financial prodigy who, as you say, blundered into the world of organized crime in a chance meeting 25 or 30 years earlier, as the book opens, with the man who would become Don Donato. And he never had to beat anybody up. He never had to shake anybody down. He just understood how to keep money, how to make money grow, and became a trusted advisor to the chief of this little gang. And you know, he's a philatelist. He collects stamps. He goes to church every Sunday. And yet he has the respect of everybody because they trust his thinking. And he went to federal prison on a bum beef to protect the then Don. And he is the kind of the soul of the enterprise, although he's only the consigliere. He's only second in command.
I want to come back to Jack. This failed ad executive opens a discount mattress store in the neighborhood. I've heard the book described as being based in some way on advertising, and I guess in some ways it is. It's not a lot about that, and I'm wondering, I guess you drew some of what you know about advertising and the advertising business from it, but what was the Schiavone connection for you? Where did he come from?
Well, he was a convenient character. It struck me funny to have this very sophisticated Manhattanite who himself, for a very different set of reasons, was down on his luck, but who himself had been convicted of a crime. He actually briefly went to prison and lost his entire fortune by covering up for a girlfriend who had been embezzling money from the ad agency of which he was president. And he's trying to reinvent himself in this working-class neighborhood in Brooklyn. And, you know, he represents, I guess, my ambivalence about the world of advertising that I covered as a critic for 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, I admire advertising. There's some advertising I love, but I don't think all that much of advertising people as a group, you know. And I think they're very misguided in many ways. And he is the expression of my ambivalence. But he's a stand-up guy, and he is handsome and gorgeous and witty and thoughtful and in his way kind of courageous. And he gets involved in this brewing mob war between the gang that couldn't shoot straight and the Russian mob, which shoots straight and often.
There is it's a hard novel to talk about in some ways because you don't want to give too much away. I guess that's always the problem talking about it. So I promise not to spoil anything. There was a moment in the book really early on. It's a very brief chapter about Anthony DePasquale and his barbershop and the bird, the parrot in his shop. Which just is a kind of a – it's such a beautiful little piece of writing. It's in the early part where you're sort of trying to get us to know the characters in the neighborhood and understand the neighborhood itself. But I loved this part. And I'm not sure. I guess did it come from – talk about this particular scene if you would, because it's so kind of touching and funny. And I guess –
Thank you. It's a little set piece. It has almost nothing to do with the plot,
right.
Although in it are points that do turn out to be to work into the plot. But the idea of most of the first half of the book is completely plot unrelated, and it's just setting up these character sketches of the people who populate this little community, and one of them is this barber.
Yeah.
Who has been filling the bag of the Cozy Nostra's bag man for years, and cutting hair and just barely making ends meet, and nonetheless doing what he can to survive, and sort of cheerfully accepting the shakedown.
Yeah.
Week after week after week, and we see him in a scene where the collector, a guy named Casper, is making his appearance, and the barber just doesn't have the money to pay him, and he is petrified. And you know, I won't say what happens when he cannot fork over his $100. But in the meantime, we see him there trying to get his parrot to talk.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get the parrot to say one simple word, and the parrot simply won't cooperate. And, you know, again, without giving up too much of what happens next, we discover the one word that he's trying to get the parrot to say is the word that will fill up a gigantic void in his life.
Yeah.
That also has virtually nothing to do with the plot, but gives you a sense that these are real people with real lives facing real problems and yet somehow still manage to cobble out a human relationship with this gang of criminals.
Mm. What have you learned, do you think, Bob Garfield, writing a novel? I mean, what have you learned about the way you have over the years written about media, about – and we'll get to this a little bit later, but the way – you know, you've written about the revolution going on right now in media and publishing and the way we process all of this. Did you learn any new insights in not writing the book itself, but trying to get it published and trying to get people to pay attention to it?
Did I learn anything? Well, yes, I did learn something. First of all, this novel went to 30 publishers before one of them decided to publish it. So that's a very common experience for first-time novelists, and it was certainly mine. And, you know, clearly 29 or 30 people were unimpressed with my other credentials. The manuscript on its face, you know, did not seem like a reasonable venture for them. But one said yes. And the one, funnily enough, was Amazon's imprint, Thomas and Mercer. And, you know, Amazon is not just a distributor of books and I think everything else under the sun, but now they're a publisher.
Right.
They're creating content. And you're a publisher like any other. And I've gone through a publishing experience now just about every which way you can. I've got a book coming out in the spring, another business book called Can't Buy Me Like, mm-hmm. that is done by Penguin Portfolio, and it is exactly like publishing has been done since time immemorial, which has always been confounding to authors and nettlesome and frustrating and often painful. And I was very curious to see. Oh, and I've also, by the way, published a book essentially myself by creating a publishing imprint with a partner. That's how we published The Chaos Scenario,
right.
which was itself about the revolution in media and the collapse of all of the mass media and mass marketing structures we'd all come to love for 300 years. That one I did myself, essentially. And now there's this kind of middle path where this digital colossus, Amazon, is now taking on publishing. And what I discovered is that for an author, they're just as much of a nightmare to work with as anyone else in the publishing business for all of exactly the same reasons. Under-resourced, not really good at making good on their promises, and you know, generally overtaxed to meet even the minimum standards of, you know, publishing competence. So, yeah, that's how this one's gone.
Bob Garfield is with us, co-host, of course, of WNYC and NPR's On the Media, which you can hear on KUER Saturdays at 2, Sundays at 10 a.m. His new book is called Bedfellows. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Bob Garfield. We're talking to him about his latest book. It's called Bedfellows. It's a novel. That and other things. And I actually want to shift gears, Bob, a little bit. You know, I was talking with one of my producers earlier today. We were thinking about the days when you used to do stories for All Things Considered. And I'm just looking at the times on some of these pieces, and we're talking about the fact you don't hear stories quite like that. I mean, 22 minutes, 18 minutes, these really long parables, I guess, is the term that comes to mind, these pieces that you used to produce. You do stuff like this, of course, on the media, but I wonder if you miss that form.
I do miss the form. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed, how satisfying it was to do that kind of reporting for All Things Considered for so many years. And, you know, often with the producers of the show kind of scratching their head as to, you know, whether a program that millions of people take extremely seriously and depend on for really the only in-depth news and analysis they're going to get in broadcasting, to have me, you know, spending 14 minutes with a woman and her pet pig, or to try to go bowling in the White House, or trying to deconstruct the unbelievably tragic life of a homeless man and his daughter's unbelievably tragic attempts after his death to find a connection with him. There's, you know, nothing in there about the world economy on my story list. There's nothing there about governance and poverty and all of the great issues of the day. But somehow they let me do it for like 2 decades, mm-hmm. and devoted all sorts of time to the kind of stories that maybe individually may seem trivial, but in the aggregate did. I mean, I don't know what they offered. Again, not for me to say, but it sure was a fun gig.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Norman Bloom. He was the New Jersey man, mentally unstable in some ways, but had this deep attraction to numbers. And you profiled him. I want to play a little bit of that piece because it's fun to go back and listen. But it also gives a sense of... as you said, that kind of tragic story of him. After he died, you went out to do this profile. And he had this theory, which you talk a little bit about in this excerpt, though, but about this connection between the Baltimore Orioles losing streak and God's will. How did you find Norman Bloom as a character you wanted to write about, first of all?
Well, I'm from Washington, and I had actually encountered him. On the streets and in my office, he had come to pitch me with his reams and reams and reams of analysis and tiny print showing these correlations between gigantic events and apparently unrelated events like the Baltimore Orioles losing streak or the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And it was his way of showing he had some sort of unified theory of the proof of God through arithmetic. And it was clearly insane. He was paranoid schizophrenic, but a genius. And it took a certain kind of genius to put this stuff together, and certainly a whole lot of persistence. Although, as was explained to me by no less a persona than a Carl Sagan, he just depended on what is called the fallacy of favorable enumeration, also called cherry picking. And he, you know, would ignore all of the arithmetic that did not support his theory and focus on arithmetical coincidences. And in that way, he thought he could prove the existence of God and God's hand in all human events. And he was a fascinating character. But I never wrote about him when he was alive because he was nuts. And I was always looking for eccentricities. That I think that in the aggregate create a sort of patchwork. But I did have a no psychotics rule. But after he died, his daughter, who was a producer in public radio in Boston, called me and said, "First of all, I want you to know that this guy is more than just an eccentric, and he has this just unbelievable treasure had." This unbelievable treasure trove of stuff, including audio, music that he had produced in his path to madness. And there's a story here. And there was a story very unlike what I anticipated, and I'm quite sure very unlike what his daughter anticipated as well.
Well, let's play a moment from this early on in the piece, and you'll hear a somewhat younger Bob Garfield here. From his story about Norman Bloom.
62J195207. At long last, three numbers that really count for Norman Bloom. The man's affinity for arithmetic isn't apt to be equaled, yet never have a few homely digits meant so much to his life. In fact, they mark the end of it. The numbers belong to safe deposit boxes in a Paterson, New Jersey bank. Here, Bloom's children sit with a state examiner to inventory the numerological ephemera he deemed worthy of a Mosler vault. Now they constitute his meager legacy.
$10 counts. These are probably closed.
No, they're not.
They're not. March 83, I don't know if it's still active or not. Might be that they've been transferred.
It's possible.
Yeah.
He wasn't your basic normal person.
No, Norman Bloom was not your basic normal person. He was an eccentric mathematician, composer, and part-time ice cream truck driver whose last 26 years were a tortured messianic odyssey. It was a search, as he once explained, for the relationship between numbers and God.
He delights in correlating the number of the occurrence with the number of the date. This is done in all areas. It's done in the stock market. Dow Jones averages on 5-3 is plus 15. 5 times 3 equals 15. On the third day of the third month of the third year, that's March 3rd, 1983, the Dow Jones changes 3.00. How can blind accident correlate this occurrence, which results from the buying and selling of millions of shares of stock, on the idea of the date? You have to have a thinking, knowing creator having the power and the wish to do this.
That was the Bloom proof, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what he called it. And, you know, this piece, which I think was 23 minutes, and which, by the way, Doug, I haven't heard in about 20 years. And it's amazing in the first instance to hear my radio voice such that it was.
Yeah,
oh my gosh, in 1993 or whenever that came out. The story was nominally about Norman Bloom and his descent into schizophrenia, but it was much more about his daughter, Marcia, and her own quixotic efforts to prove a connection between her father and herself, which just never existed.
Right.
She was trying to find her daddy, and I think what this piece was about was that her efforts to do that with a man who was just so in unreality were as futile and vain as his attempt to prove to the world that he was the Messiah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you. I think that's my magnum opus as a journalist. And, I'm not sure, but I spent a year doing it.
Yeah.
And it was, it was an experience.
Well, I want to say, we're going to put a link to that story on our website because it's really extraordinary. So lovely, so sad. You really sound like you're proud of it.
I am proud of it. And, you know, I think I've cobbled together an interesting career, but the things that I cherish are little individual moments along the way, and that's certainly one of them. It was just to immerse yourself into this kind of person's life, and to create the kind of connections I did with the sources of the story, mainly his family. It was a very unusual, as much as my reporting was in those days, it was a very unusual path to get into the human psyche.
Yeah.
And I feel very privileged that all things considered permitted me to do that.
Well, what was it that got you thinking about trying to get into the White House to go bowling?
I wanted to go bowling with my family. You know, it was a Saturday. I wanted to go bowling.
Yeah.
And I called the local lanes, you know, and they said, nope, sorry, league play only. And I called another lanes and they said, nope, sorry, it's all leagues. I couldn't go bowling. And I live in Washington and I knew that there was a bowling alley just sitting idle. And it was the one Nixon built in the White House.
Yeah.
So it occurred to me that we should really go bowling there. And the piece was, again, nominally about my attempts to actually get me and my wife and kids into the bowling alley. for the humor and shock value that would ensue, but also as a kind of parable about political influence.
Yeah.
Because I tried everything. And the idea was to do it over the course of a summer, little, you know, incrementally tried to work my way in. And but it actually all happened fairly quickly. So it turned into one very long parable of political influence in our nation's capital.
Well, let me play a moment here because there's one part of the piece where you are talking to the head lobbyist of the American Bowling Association or whatever the organization was, and you're talking
yeah.
about how you can – how maybe this person can wield some influence. And the guy says, well, look, you know, maybe we can do this and maybe we can do that. But, you know, this is going to take a while. And that's where this sort of moment picks up because, as you say, you didn't have 3 weeks or whatever it was.
I needed fast action. I needed instant gratification. I needed America's number one top-of-the-charts political strategist. To get me into the White House, I needed the guy credited for getting Bill Clinton in the White House.
Okay, this is James.
James Carville, political miracle worker, who said that to book the lane, I'd have to get the president's attention, do something that would help him sell his programs, or really do anything that might catch his eye.
You could feign some illness and say that, you know, to let your last request is to, you know, throw a bowling ball down a thing, you know, like the kid used to do with Babe Ruth, you know. You could move to Arkansas and hurry up and develop a relationship with one of his lifelong childhood friends that come to Washington from time to time. So you could find some single woman that's a friend of Mrs. Clinton's and start dating. Do you have any looks or you have any kind of social abilities or something like that? Maybe you could try that.
You have any looks? That's so great. We should say you got in. I mean, I remember the story. I'm not sure how many people listening remember the story, but you got in with your family to the White House bowling alley.
Yeah, we did. It was my wife and daughters and myself and the social secretary for the president of the United States in heels, I might add. And, you know, we rolled a game. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And along the path, you know, I got Ralph Nader involved. Yep. I got my local congressman involved. Yep. I talked to a senator about a bill that was very much in contention in the Congress at the time. I tried everything. And, yeah, we made it.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. You ever feel like you talked about juggling so many different kinds of things. Is that just your nature? Or is it that you haven't quite found the thing yet?
Well, Doug, you get to the core of things as you are wont to do. No, I God, Doug, I never really thought of it that way. I mean, I've always known that I have a kind of attention deficit, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of a multi-mediocrity, and I, you know, I have I like that image of myself, and it keeps me from being bored.
Yeah,
I don't know that I would have succeeded just focusing on one thing my whole life. Maybe it's a bit dilettantish of me, but I like having a lot of stuff that I do. I wrote a bad sitcom. I wrote a pretty good country song. I've got an unproduced play in my desk drawer and a couple of really, really dreadful screenplays. And, you know, it's fun going to work not knowing that you can do like 11 different kinds of things all in one day.
Mm-hmm.
But does this actually bespeak a void that I have somehow left unfulfilled, the thing that I really should be? And I don't know. I don't know. I don't think so. I think I feel whole by being the sum of my parts. But in any event, I am so old. It's too late to find the real me.
Right.
I am a senior American and failing rapidly.
I want to ask you finally about. I want to come. We spoke in 2008 when your book, The Chaos Scenario, came out. Where you were writing about, again, this revolution in media. And I'm wondering, you mentioned at the time you weren't talking about the death of media, but a kind of a rebirth of media. 8 years on or whatever it is, what does the landscape look like for you now? Is it going the way you thought it would, or are you surprised at all?
The only thing that surprises me is that I made a number of predictions. You know, the collapse of the newspaper industry, check. The collapse of the music industry, check. The collapse of the publishing industry, check. And that basically the collapse of the advertising industry, check. Basically, we lived in this period of 300 years where we're this perfect symbiosis between mass marketing and mass media, and it was all collapsing because of the great, among other things, the great fragmentation of digital media. Yeah. We took away monopolies. Everybody could be a content creator and distributor, and it created hyper-fragmentation, which destroyed the old model. So everything happened more or less according to plan. So, yeah, I guess I saw it coming. And it's all played out approximately as I described. But the network television has survived. It's not thrived. It's still on the brink. But it's survived in approximately the same form for longer than I thought it would. I really thought we were seeing its last days. But and I still think, you know, in the long term, we are seeing network television, broadcast television, and broadcast in general in their last days. But I just don't know what the end time quite is. I'm not sure if we're in the end time, or the early part of the end time, or something just before that. But it's been remarkably resilient.
Mm. It's Bob Garfield, co-host of WNYC and NPR's On the Media, which you can hear on KUER Saturdays at 2, Sundays at 10. He's the author of a new novel. It's called Bedfellows, and he joined us from some undisclosed location. Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
No, Doug, you know, nobody ever says you're welcome on public radio, but I'm going to refuse myself to say you're welcome. I just want to thank you again. This has been a wonderful hour, a great opportunity, and I appreciate your having me on.
Talk to you again. Thanks.
Sure thing.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks to Taylor Almond, the show produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.